F1A. Number 6B.
Then, just to finish the picture of the vertical, I tried to take in also the major prophet, Isaiah. Naturally, Isaiah has about 66 chapters. It's a terrific big book. And it is actually three books, some say two books. They call it the first Isaiah, that's from chapter 1 to 40, or 39, I'm not quite sure now. Then Deutero Isaiah, which is quite a different book from chapter 40 or 41 onward. Some think that the last about 10 chapters are again from another prophet, Tritro Isaiah, I think you say Tritro Isaiah, a third Isaiah. No matter what that is, they have one common denominator. Isaiah has one big common denominator. And that big common denominator is again God, the bigness of God, that demands understanding. Right from the beginning, the accent is on understanding God. Just as we have it here in the matrix at 1D, we have the call for understanding. You know, it's a beautiful thing. If you only you read the first chapter of Isaiah, which gives the tone, the key note, so to say, for the whole of Isaiah, then you see it at once what he wants to say, something which the other prophets, the other minor prophets, never touch upon, really. Namely, that right from the beginning he says, well, you know, even every ox knows his owner, and even every ass knows his master's crib. They know where to go. Every ox knows where to go and where he belongs to. But Israel does not know his God. That's right at the beginning. And so introduces right at the beginning that what is lacking with Israel is that Israel does not know God. We would say that he does not understand God. And as one reads further and further and has all these wonderful stories and stories, they all turn around one common denominator. Constantly, it is the call of God to Israel that Israel should have knowledge, that Israel should consider, that Israel should understand, that Israel should be reasoning rightly with God, that there should be learning in Israel, that there should be wisdom, that there should be counsel. Can you hear the tone that is always the same, always turns around, that Israel should know, that Israel should have understanding of God? That you don't have neither in Hosea, neither in Joel, neither in Amos, neither in the following minor prophets. This is something typical for the major prophets. Here in Isaiah, it's just one thing, namely that God, we are in the first column, the first vertical, that the power of God is so that the power of God demands of Israel to know God, to understand God. And though Israel is a stiff-necked nation and does not want to know, he shows, well, I'm using all the tricks that I have until Israel begins to know God and wants to know God. And that goes right through the whole book of Isaiah. Even when you come to Deutero Isaiah, the second Isaiah there, you get the constantly that God postulates the determined enforcement of an understanding of God. So that Israel just does not have any more a chance not to know God. And we know how that happened. We know so well that he was prophesying, especially the first Isaiah was prophesying before the captivity of the northern kingdom of Israel, the captivity in Assyria. What happened in those captivity, later on then, when Israel still didn't want to know, then Judah was brought into captivity. And the prophets, all the prophets said, Israel will be brought into captivity. It's the plan of God to bring Israel into captivity. Think how popular those prophets were in Israel. That Israel who thought, we are the chosen people. We alone have a big God. We have a God that is the God that is much mightier than any other God of the other countries. All the other gods in Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Syria, the Scythian gods and so on, they were all little gods compared with the Lord Jehovah. And then to have a prophet that comes to the chosen people and say, God wants you to go into captivity. And that's the plan of the Christ, and you can't stop it. You will have to go. You can see how popular they were. Well, you see, we are in a similar situation today. Nobody wants to listen. Nobody wants to listen what's coming. There are a few prophets in the world that say, look here, we are right at the edge of a precipice, and it only needs a little push and you are down. And it's a dangerous thing to walk on that precipice and be safe. You never know when you slip and down you are. You never know if somebody puts the wrong button and down you are. We are in a very similar position. Here comes the spiritual thinkers, here comes the thinkers from the realm of the physicist, of the biologist, of the ecologist. All they come and say, look here, it's 12:05 or 11:55, according to what they say. But we don't believe it. You find very rarely somebody who believes it. They said, oh, well, let's get on. Up to now we could solve every question. Yes, up to now we could solve every question. But how? Through how many pains? Through how much suffering? Through how much loss? So these prophets are very new to us. They are living us. And therefore what we also say, on what we begin to see, if there is no knowledge, if there is no understanding of God in its science, and not God as a mystical being, if there is no knowledge and understanding of God in its science that is reflected within our consciousness as a structured sense of consciousness of divine ideas and the tonality of the synonymous term, I don't see why we should be saved. I don't see why we should be saved. What should be saved? All what does not belong to this is anyway not right. Is anyway not of the nature of God. So why should that be saved? So on one side there will be science and peace, and on the other side there will be dismay and disaster. But that's what the prophets always said. And that's not what the prophet said. That's what the Christ idea has in mind. That's the point. Not the prophets. They were just channels through which the Christ idea was speaking. Just as Mrs. Eddy was only a channel through which God was speaking. And she was a scribe under order, and so were the prophets, scribes under order. So we must see, we don't have to listen to prophets, we listen to the Christ idea. And the Christ idea is always the Christ idea, no matter if it was 2,500 years ago or if it's today. It's always the Christ idea that does not want any ignorance to survive. Whatever is of the nature of ignorance, of not knowing reality, is not worth surviving. Therefore, the Christ idea says, I give you any chance to understand what's going on in reality, but don't think that I will save what is wrong. I'm not going to do that. Because the Christ has an identity and cannot be both sides, good and evil. Cannot. So that would be the first big column, the vertical of the Christ. Yes? Now we go over it again. Just to get the flow of it, just to feel the flow of the Spirit, that the Spirit blows where it listens, so that we don't put the Spirit into a straitjacket of the words and of letters and of terms, that we don't put the Spirit into the straitjacket of a system that we have only learned, that we only repeat in terms, but that it is something that is spiritually tangible, spiritually flowing, and gives us an inner sense of peace and rest, a sense of fulfillment within ourselves. So, while for a long time we were asking the students to do a lot of study and deep study, I still do that at a certain stage, and I think it's still the best one can do, but then there must also come a time when that letter has been cultivated enough, when it is crystallizing itself, that then comes the most important part, which Mrs. Eddy puts at the end of the textbook and says, take it and ponder it. Pondering it does not mean to put one's nose into a book or see constantly lists of ideas and things like that, but to use the study that one has made and lean back and try to feel really the holiness of it, the spiritual reality of it, the spiritual touch of it, the spiritual promise of it, the spiritual welcome of it. So here we could go over this column again and can see, perhaps we stress this time, the step-by-step unfoldment through the relative sense of word, Christ, Christianity and science. And just hear with your spiritual ear how God really comes down, so to say, how the Christ comes down to the counterfeit, what does it do to the counterfeit, what is left of the counterfeit, namely nothing, and that is something that goes on in our understanding. And understanding has nothing to do with thinking rightly, has nothing to do with knowing something, but has to do with spiritually seeing the connections between those two, the relationship of these factors. So let's listen again. We can, in any situation, we can sit back and look into the immensity of reality and say to ourselves, I'm not interested in unreality. If I want to know something, I want to know that reality that is ever going on. And in that reality, there is a Christ operating. So I come first to the proof category of the Christ and begin to see there is a dynamic idea at work. I don't have to move my fingers, I don't have to move my hands, I don't have to move a table, I don't have to move anything. The Christ is self-operative. That comes to our first vertical as the omnipower, the monopotency, the only power of God that is only the power of good. And what do I see spiritually? In the symbolism of the four prophets, I begin to see that God is always righteous, that he always has a right idea in view. Therefore, that God is only that power at work right now in the universe, within me, within everything that concerns the universe and every individual aspect, universally, collectively, individually, there is only one power at work, and that power is good, and I rely on that, and I see there is no other power at work. Which means that Hosea defines that there are not two powers at work, an evil and a good power. There is only one power at work that is good, and if we are in our consciousness alive to that power, we experience that power as good only. And only when we are not walking in that way, we fall in that way. That's the only thing. So I begin to realize that if I align myself through prayer, through Atonement Eucharist, with that one power, then it expresses itself as God good. God good. What then about all the evil powers that I see around me? Aren't they there? Isn't there, I come to church, isn't there an army of evil just around about me? Don't I see how everything goes wrong in the world? Don't I see how that creeps in into every consciousness and fills up every consciousness? And so I have to find an answer to that. And so Joel says, well, you see, you return to the Lord. Go back to your Hosea and stick with Hosea. Stick with Hosea, then you can't see an army of evil. Then you can only see that the army of the Lord is ever at work. Don't be so fool and get away from the Lord. Go back, return to the Lord, O Israel. And Israel, return to the Lord, and returning to the Lord, he could see that the Lord would restore all the years that the locusts have eaten. That it would be a great army that would really restore everything that was cut off among you. And so I begin to realize that I can never lose anything by a false belief if I return to my original standpoint of God as the only power. Where is then evil when I go back to the Lord? Amos comes along and says, you know, all that what you called evil has disappeared. It has been destroyed. And Amos says, the Lord has destroyed the counterfeit of mind, and he has destroyed the counterfeit of spirit, and the counterfeit of soul, the counterfeit of principle, and of life, and truth, and love. And he has all that wiped away. There is nothing left. And he has restored the house of David. It wasn't the house of David, I can't remember right now, but it was the tabernacle of David, which is a better name. The whole structure, the tabernacle, which was the symbol of the church and the temple, therefore the structure of the Jewish theology. Wonderful. So I feel, therefore, evil has never been a reality. Evil has never been a somethingness. There's always been a nothingness. So why should I fear it? Why should I fear it? Well, because I have not understood God. Therefore, I have gone through suffering. Should I go always through suffering if God is good? No, I shouldn't. So Isaiah comes and says, you know, you shouldn't go through suffering. But in order not to go through suffering, you have to understand God. So get up and begin to understand God, to learn what God is. Seek unto God. And don't seek unto them that have familiar spirits and wizards, that people that matter. Should not the people seek their God? That's what Isaiah said. Then, if you seek God, you will never advance through suffering. And you will advance through understanding. A terrific picture. So consider, learn, research, study, have wisdom, take counsel. All that was there in Isaiah. That's why we are at that point where we say, yes, we should really take the textbook and the Bible and really begin to research it like Isaiah has done or has demanded us to do, to find the science of being. And not to go to a class in order to have more matter, to spiritualize matter and materialize spirit, not for any ulterior motive. It should always be for the glory of understanding God. If you do that, you can be quite sure that the army of the locusts will no more come. This is my old war song, since I started teaching, since I began to know something about Christian Science as a boy. I had it right from there, namely that old war song. If we take the whole, then the parts cannot do anything harm. If we take the whole, then and take the whole as good, then there is no chance for evil to raise its head. But if we run after little things, after the asses that the father of soul has lost, and run after those asses and try to find them, then we have a bad job before us. But if we take, like Saul did it, and go up on the mountain and go to the prophet and say, "You prophet, you tell me where the asses are." Then the prophet said to little Saul, "I don't tell you where the asses are, but I make you governor over whole Israel. I make you king over the whole of the land. If you take in the whole, the parts are found." And you don't have to use metaphysics for every little problem and to run after every little ass to find it. If you take the whole, that's the 7,000 year period. If we take really within ourselves the whole tonality of our root notions, then you can be quite sure that we don't have to deal with individual problems anymore. They cannot arise anymore. Not because we solve them, because they cannot arise anymore. That's something Christian scientists in general never want to accept. That's why they have problems all through their lives. That's why they need always a practitioner. That's why they talk about my practitioner. That's bad. That's really bad. That means that we have a mediator between God and us who looks after us. In science, we are one with God. And if we have an understanding of God, we don't need a mediator, a personal mediator. If we have a oneness with God, as we see here in the prophet, then no evil can arise anymore. The house, the tabernacle of David is established. But if we don't do that, if we think we can get around it and be superficial, that we can be a lame duck in science, then we will have just as many problems as the non-scientists. Or I would say even more. Even more. Because we are not faithful to an idea. Because we betray the idea that is put into our lap as a gift of God, as a grace of God. So, Isaiah was right. That big prophet that was afterwards prophesying that there will be a Christ coming, the King of Kings will be coming. But first he said, turn to the Lord. Know God. Know Him. Don't be so... Every ox knows his master's crib. Why should not man, who can think, who can have understanding, why should he not be able to know his master, his God? And that's our job. And this is a good job. All right, tomorrow we will go to the next vertical.